to start tonight, what I'd like you to do is just, let's think together, let's just close our eyes and think of one moment in life, a time, whether it was recently or more further back in our lives, of a moment of helplessness. Just a moment in life where we felt that the circumstances were getting the better of us, and we really had no ability to be able to change or shape our own reality. I'm sure we can. There are many times we can identify such a moment. And then let's move back into another point in life where there was a decision that we made in life which was so profound and so strong. And we look back and we see that that fork in the road was so supremely important in the guiding of our lives. Now, that was really a turning point. That if we'd taken the other decision, we would be in a very different place. And I'm sure we can all think back to points in our lives where that we have that sense of helplessness in the storm of circumstance, and we can think back to the moments of very powerful decision-making. And what this journey is about, that we're about to encounter, the journey that Ruth, Naomi, and Orpah are about to encounter, is that journey where of oscillation between helplessness and on the other extreme, the power of choice. That's really what this decision, what this journey is about. Let's sort of try to identify in them their decisions, their helplessness, and try to get a sense of the just the magnitude of the decisions that they have to face in their way back. We left off last time with the first five psukim of really unmitigated tragedy. It was just terrible. We met the family of Naomi. We saw what happened to them in a very short span of time. And now she's left with no nuclear family and her daughters-in-law from another culture. That's really where we stopped. So let's take it a little further now into the next section, our journey back. In the journey back, we're going to start on Pasuk Vav. This is to be found on the bottom of the first page, just beneath the double lines. And we're told the following. Vatokom hidachaloseah, she arose with her daughters-in-law. Vatoshav miste Moav, and she returned from the fields of Moav. Ki shama biste Moav, because she heard in the fields of Moav. Ki fokad Hashem esamah, that God appointed his people, laseis lahem lechem, to give them bread. A lot going on over here. There's a lot going on. How many people are on this journey? There are three people on this journey. So why does it say that she returned? Do you see that? There's three people on this journey, but it says Vatoshav, that she returns. That means to say that what's going on over here?
She initiated.
So she initiated, which means to say that this trip that's going on, although it includes three people, who's driving is really very much Naomi. Let's reverse for a moment now. Let's think beforehand. Beforehand, there was a trip down to the Stei Moav, and in fact, who was the passive party in that was herself. It says that it was very much, and the psukim indicated that it was Elimelech's decision, that he is going to go down, and she was the passive party to that decision. It's interesting that at the return, she is the active party, and the others are the hangers-on. That's what number one what we should notice in the psukim over here, is that emphasis. Moreover, why does she return? What is the point of her return now? Famine is over. So if on a practical level, she left because there was famine, so the return is because the absence of famine. That sounds straightforward enough. However, what we discussed a little bit was when the famine actually hit, it was a localized famine. Localized famines indicate what? There might be, if you'd have something which is rather than like just a global strike, a global issue, then you might say that, well, there's certain areas which might be, there might be a God focus, there might be a divine aspect to what's going on over here. But nonetheless, Elimelech closed his, put down his shutters, didn't take notice and left. What's happening over here? How's the correction occurring? Is she's not just listening to the news. She's not just reading on the headlines, oh wow, the stock prices are going up, and the market's reinvesting, and the agriculture is taking a turn. She's not reading that. What's she reading into it? She's reading Hashem's name into it. Ki fokar Hashem esamoy lasas lahem lechem. That Hashem gave them back bread. So the correction process for their escape, or perhaps their refuge, was the fact that they weren't really taking notice of the implications, the religious implications of global affairs. And the way they come back is, as opposed to the passive party, she's the active party, and as opposed to reading just news, she's investing into that news some form of spiritual content. So you see what you see already just in the return, Naomi's undergone a transformation. Or she is now becoming the person, the leader of this group. If you were in Naomi's place, where would the last place you would want to go to be at this point in your life? I would say that the last place you'd want to be going is the people who knew you. Remember, here's the princess of wealth, the queen of aristocracy, leaves with everything. And why does she leave? We're told that because they try to escape the responsibility of the time, right? So now she comes, so okay, that's true, it was her husband making the decision, but nonetheless, as a family unit, they disappear. She was the power that could have been, and now she returns with no family, no money, and she returns to that place. Can you imagine just trying to put yourself into her shoes for that moment, the degradation of that? She would probably want to run to the furthest ends of the earth, not to be recognized by anybody, but nonetheless, she goes right back in, because sometimes issues which are unresolved don't get resolved by sweeping them further under the carpet. She wants to come to peace with her life. She wants to rectify what's gone on. And therefore she goes back, she charges straight back into the epicenter of what's going to be a very painful but necessary journey. And this is what we see going on over here. So just in one pasuk already, there's a lot going on over here in the life of Naomi, in the psyche of Naomi. Let's take it a little further. She leaves the place that she was there. Again, we're all in singular. And her two daughters-in-law with her. And they go upon the way to the land of Yehuda. Now, generally speaking, if you go somewhere, it automatically means that you have to have left somewhere, right? It's just one of these things that kind of go hand in hand. You can't go somewhere without having left somewhere else. So, therefore, meaning it's, if I have a point A and I have a point B, I have to describe it in two ways. I can either say I went to point B or I can say I left point A. But nonetheless, however you're going to describe it, depending which direction you're focusing on, it's really the same action, essentially. It's the movement from point A to point B. Where else do we see such a dynamic in the Torah? Great. So the beginning of Parashas Vayetze is, it says, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva vayelech Charana. It says that Yaakov left from Be'er Sheva and he went to Charan, which is again doing the same thing. The Torah is emphasizing both getting somewhere and leaving somewhere. Same thing as Naomi, which is why Rashi, actually, on the beginning of Parashas Vayetze, says that yes, Naomi is the same model, and that is that when the Torah emphasizes the leaving, not because we don't know that, we know that she had to have left to have gone, but because when she left, or when Yaakov Avinu left, there was an impression there was a void which was being created. So it's not just that she went somewhere. We're being told that there was a yetziyah, that there was a departure, because now Stei Moav, the area she was in, is no longer the same area. There's the people are now feeling the absence of her presence, which now deepens, if you think about it, deepens the sacrifice she's making. She is going back to be on the soup kitchen list in Beis Lechem, right? She is now going to be the bottom echelon of society, but nonetheless, she's leaving a place where we're told that her impression is being left. So you can see that even though she may not have been, we'll call it the top of the totem pole in Moab, she was something, the impression was felt, and this adds again to the magnitude of this decision over here that she's making. You see something also interesting is if you put yourself now, if you take ourselves out of the character of Naomi and we throw ourselves into the character of these daughters-in-law, why would they possibly be coming with her? I mean, why would they be sticking with her?
They're accompanying her. It doesn't necessarily say they're going with her.
Okay, so it could be that they're accompanying her to the border and they're escorting her, right? It could be that they're escorting her, but it seems like from where we're about to see her, so pushback, it sounds like that they do intend for some reason to even go beyond that. So what is going through their minds? What could possibly be on their minds, on their hearts, which is pushing them this direction? Right?
But she has success. Where she is, she's important, and she commands an attention, and they want to be attached to that.
There's something about Naomi herself, meaning they see there's something about her, meaning even her name, Naomi Pleasant. There's something very charismatic, whether it be even through difficult circumstances, they feel that she's a person that they want to be around, even though she's not in her highest point in her career. That's very possible, which shows you just the power of character.
Isn't it also possible that the same way that the Jewish people were not happy that they married into Moab, maybe the Moab people were unhappy?
Interesting. So good.
So it's almost like they're
good question.
Goods. They're going to go back.
So then you're saying that maybe they're being ostracized in their natural culture. Mm-hmm. Very fascinating. I never even thought about that. The decision they had to make to extricate themselves from society. I hadn't even thought about it from that perspective. Very, very possible. You know, so if you want to dig that a little deeper, what the first suggestion is what the Midrash says. What Autumn had said. The Midrash suggests exactly what the Autumn says, that it was Naomi's power. But then I don't have the Midrash over here. But the Nachal Yosef, a later commentary, says that what's happening over here is it's a testament not necessarily to the relationship of Naomi and her daughter Zinor, but rather it's a testament to the relationship of Machlel and Kilion and their daughters in law. No, we don't have such a good rap on them because they died before we could really know much more about them. But at the same time, maybe you see something interesting over here, is that they were really worth it. And so coming back to Lynn's point, is that they left their culture. But why did they leave their culture? It must have been for something worth it. So maybe what happened was is that we're seeing over here real dedication. Here they are, they're widows, but nonetheless they feel this endearment to their departed husbands, which is remarkable. You see that there must have been something very special about the relationship, at least at the beginning, enough to pull them this far.
Aren't
they daughters of a king? Yes, so there's Midrashim which suggests that they might have been the daughters of a king, which is even sort of emphasizes that even further.
But wouldn't that normally mean that the king would have made a decision that day?
Good question. So yeah, it might have been that they came from aristocracy, so they're marrying aristocracy, so then they'll go again not in the same direction that Lynn was suggesting. Point well taken, no. So let's now delve deeper. Ches and test together. Vatomer Naomi l'shteichar oseli leichna shovna isha levesima. Yas Hashem imachem chesed kasher is asisem ima meisim imadi. She says, you know what? Return to the house of your mothers, and Hashem should return chesed to you like you did with me. Yitena Hashem lachem umitzena menucha isha beis isha. She says, Hashem should give you rest, serenity. Isha beis isha in your own houses. Vatishak lohen, she kisses them. Vatisena kolana kolan vativkena, and they raise their voices and they weep. So the Mefarshim debates, you know, the Malbim debates whether they were escorting her and she's saying, you know, thanks for the chesed of coming this far, but now this is more than enough, or whether they were really trying to go further. It's hard to really know as to what's going on over here. But what is the menucha that she's saying to them? Most of the Mefarshim suggest even Ezra suggests that it's referring to her husband. Is they're in a sort of, we're going to see in a moment, they're in a in-between state. They're in the balance of relationship. And she says, don't keep thinking about my family. Think about yourselves, your future. There's a lot ahead of you. And that could be a husband. The Malbim says it just means to say, start your own house, start your own life. Don't live in the shadow of the past. But the point is that what she's trying to do is, as much as it would mean something for her, remember, she's walking out of the last relationship she really has. Nonetheless, Naomi is thinking about not herself, but she's thinking about her daughters-in-law, which is a very powerful statement. And they nonetheless persist, Vatomarna lo, and they say to her, Ki tochna shuv la'amech, no, in Pasuk Yud, we return to your people. And once again, she pushes them off. Vatomar Naomi, shovna b'nosai, loma talachni imi, why do you go with me? Ha'od li vonim b'me'ai, do I still have children in my womb, v'ayu lachem la'noshim, that they should be to you as husbands. Shovna v'nosai leichna, please return, go. Ki zakanti mios le'ish, I'm too old to marry. Ki amarti yesh li tikva, gama yisi halayla le'ish. Let's say I was able to remarry, and I conceived. V'gam yoladati vonim, and I would have children. Halohen t'saberna ad asher yigdalu. Halohen t'agena l'vyiltihi yos le'ish. Al b'nosai, ki marli mikem, Hashem's hand was against me. The middle set part of the sentence is complex. She says, you will be halahen to saberna. What does the word to saberna mean?
No. To hold.
Yeah, so the way we use it is Einei kol eilecha. In Ashrei we say Einei kol eilecha yesabeiru, that the eyes of all creation turn to you in this hope. But it's more than even hope. It's this anticipation. It's this expecting that all of creation looks towards God. So you're going to be sitting there waiting and expecting, but without actualization. Until the children grow older? What is the underlying argument that Naomi is making over here? What's the issue at stake, which is Naomi is trying to convey? So what happens is that there is a section in the Torah called Yibum. So let's just recap that So 1 second, let's just recap the section itself, then we can deal with the specifics. So that's the parasha of Yibum appears. Let's see where I put it in this booklet. It's actually on page 16. Page 16 on the deeper level in the Pesukim, Perek Gimel. So this is to be found at the end, or towards the end of Sefer Devarim. And the Pesukim tell us the following: Ki yeshu achim yachdav. If there are two brothers, it's towards the middle of the page, by source one, says Ki yeshu achim yachdav. If there are two brothers who live together, u'meisechad mehenu venein loy, and one dies prematurely, has no children, loy siya eshes hameis hachutz al ishzar. So the wife of the brother should not marry somebody else. So what happens is you have two brothers, one's married. The one who's married dies, there's a widow, and they have no children. So she shouldn't marry anybody else. They should marry. The brother-in-law should marry his sister-in-law. And they create the system called Yibum. And the child that is born from this new union, from the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law, will establish Yakum al Shem Echal Hames, will be almost a resurrection of the lost brother. Because remember, his lineage has disappeared, and the child through her and his brother is somehow resurrecting that memory or that lineage of his. V'lo yimachesh shmo Yisrael, and his name should not be annulled or wiped out from Israel. This is going to be very important. We're going to study the rest of this parasha in close detail later on about the person who doesn't want to establish the name of his brother. Now, as Barbara was pointing out, that this seems to be a very specific halacha referring to brothers. So you would expect it to only be in the circumstances of brothers. However, we already see that in Tanakh, there's an expanded sense of Yibum, which applies in many areas. One example is by Yehuda and Tamar, where you see that what happens is that there is Yehuda has three sons, and the first son marries a woman called Tamar. Tamar, he dies. The next son marries Tamar. Is apparently this type of activity, Yibum, to establish the lost son number one, heir, and so therefore Onan, son number two, marries. Onan also dies. And she's now in line to marry Shelah, and Yehuda withholds. He's scared to lose all three sons. He apparently, by the way, just interestingly enough, he apparently thinks that the weight of the loss was her responsibility, not his. Which is interesting, because perhaps his acceptance at the end of Tzad Kami Meni means that he took responsibility, perhaps, for some of that, not putting it on her. But what ends up happening is that she seduces him. And in that act, she's ultimately continuing her previous husband's line through Yehuda, which is where we're stretching a little bit beyond the brothers. And what you see over here is Naomi is trying to do something which is very unusual. Naomi is saying, even if you think that, look, you were married to two fine young men, and they had no children, they had no future. I have no future. Elimelech has no future in terms of continuation, and you think that you want to be the noble people to continue that lineage, it's not going to work, because, simply, there's no other children. And even, let's say, in the most miraculous situation, that let's say I were to have a child in 9 months' time from now, and now that would be your way of perhaps continuing the lineage through that child as the brother, she says, well, you're going to, by the time that child grows up to marriageable age, you're going to have lost your life. You're going to have wasted away in that time. Ain't saberno adim ade asher yigdolu, until they grow up. Therefore, she says, "Albanosai ki marli ma'od mikem." It embitters me so much from you. What is she saying? What is so bitter about you now? What's so bitter about them that she's emphasizing here? Is maybe what she's saying is that if I look at you and I see that you're suffering as well as I'm suffering, I couldn't live with that. I can live with myself suffering, but I can't watch you waiting and hoping to reestablish some legacy on my behalf. I can't witness that pain. It's too bitter for me to be in your presence for that. And more than that, maybe even is, and this is something which, unfortunately, we know to be true, is when she looks at them, who's she looking at?
Her sons.
You know, maybe when she looks at them, she's looking at her sons, and she says, "It's too hard for me to be around you, even." So she's asking them to please desist, because in them she sees her tragedy compounded. Maybe she can escape that as she leaves them, which is what's happening. Let's charge on. I wanted to focus on one particular detail here for a moment, but let's first get to Pasuk Yud Zayin. The psukim go as follows. In Pasuk Yud Dalet, we're going to start in Pasuk Yud Dalet now. Vatisena kolan, and they raised their voices. Vatifkena od, and they cried more. Vatishak or polachamosa. So once again they cry. It's obviously a heart wrenching decision which they're going through, and Ra'arpa kisses her mother-in-law, for Rus davka ba. But Rus nonetheless cleaves to her mother-in-law. Va'yuvatomer hinei shava yimintech elamo be'elheha shuvi achare yimintech. So Naomi says, pushes one last time, a third time, and says, "Look, your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods, right? Being her pagan culture. Go back after her as well." And finally, Rus makes the final argument. "Vatomer Rus al tifki ibi, don't engage with me. Ki la'azveich la'shuv me'achoraych, to make me leave you, to return from behind you. Ki alasher telchi eleich, to where you go, I will go. Vasher tolini olin, where you will dwell, I will dwell. Ameich ami, your people is my people. Ve'lokayich elokai, and your God is my God. Ba'asher tamus yamus, where you die, I will die. V'shomek over, and there I will be buried. Ko ya'aseh Hashem li, so should God do to me. V'ko yosef, and so should Hashem continue. Ki amaves yafrid ben yuvenecho. Because death will be the only thing that parts us." Which is, by the way, interesting how that feeds into certain marriage ceremonies. But originally very biblical, after all. So let's just think about Rus for just a moment here. This is quite a remarkable speech, one of the most famous speeches, which is actually given. And what the Meforshim learn from here are multitudes of halachas about Geirus, because this is one of the more expanded descriptions of Geirus in Tanakh. And many, many halachas are learned out of here about what goes on over here. You notice that, of course, Naomi pushes her back three times, and then finally, Rus charges through on the third time, and no longer argues. But there are many interesting halachas which are learnt from here. Rashi says something quite remarkable. If I could just draw your attention for a moment to the top of page 15. Top of page 15. This is the Rashi. It's in source 3. Rashi is on this pasuk, and he says, this is the larger paragraph of Rashi, four lines in. Okay, it says, "Ki el asher telchi elech, to where you go, I will go." Mikan omru raboseinu zal. Our Chazal learned from here, from this particular episode, "Ger shebol iskayer moedin lo miktsas oinshim." That from this conversation, in fact, you learn some interesting halachos ageirus, which is that you tell a prospective person who's looking to convert some of the repercussions or the of being involved in this religion, shimbolach zorboy yachzor, so that they should, if this is a good point to return, not knowing the gravity of this religion. Shemitah dvarim shel Rus ato lomed. You can understand from what Rus is saying what Naomi said to her between the lines, what is not recorded. So Naomi says, look, there's limitations on where you walk. You can't just walk anywhere. You know, there's limitations. If you go visit Uganda and there's no Erev there, you can't just walk. 2,000 amos on a Shabbos. So she says, "Ba'asher tel chielech." She says, "I'll accept the limitations, the curtailing of where I walk." Asur lano liyisyached nekeva im zachar she'ena isha. She says, "Look, there's limitations on who you spend time with in intimate time with. If you're a male and a female can't spend time if they're not married together in intimate settings." She says, "Amar lo ba'asher tolin mi'alin, I will sleep where you sleep." Meaning, I'm going to accept those boundaries in my life. Imon amenu muvdalin me'ashar amim b'shesh me'os shalosh esrei mitzvos. And she says, look, our people have got a lot of these commandments. There's 613 of them. She says, Amechami, your people's my people. And she says, but you know, we can't bring the pantheon back with you. You know that there's only one God. She says, Lokai Lokai, your God is mine. Arba misos nimsuru lebeistin. She says, but there's capital punishment too. You know, you cross that red line and there's repercussions. She responds, Aba Sher Tamusi Amus. And she says, I'm going to die where you die. What you see, what Rashi is saying, deriving from the Midrash, is that her response or her accepting of all different, I guess, quadrants of Jewish life, that she's either preempting or responding to in the conversation over here with Naomi. If you dig it even further, a number of the Mephoroshim also point out something quite remarkable, and that is that maybe what she's actually saying is not just relating to specific arenas in Judaism, but she's perhaps approximating the principles of belief itself in her speech. We know that the Rambam, when asked, what does a Jew need to believe? The Rambam answered, magic number is 13. There's 13 principles of faith. This last summer we had the opportunity of learning through, we got up to just after 5. In the summer, there's 13 principles of faith. There were those who argued with the Rambam. One most notable was known as the Sefer HaYikarim, Rav Yosef Alba. Rav Yosef Alba argued and said, Rambam, what you're saying is that these are incontrovertible. These are the parameters of religion. I disagree with them because really, they're only three. There are only three parameters of religion, and they are the belief in God, and the the fact that the Torah is divine, and finally that there is schar v'onesh, that there is reward and punishment. It's fascinating to see philosophically why those are necessary components for religion in general, and Judaism in specific. But nonetheless, the Malbim points out, if you look in his psukim, when she says Elokai Elokai, what she's doing is she's saying, I'm accepting, number one, the framework that there is a creator, there is a God. When she says Basher Telchi Elchi, she's saying, I'm going to walk in the ways of your people, which is essentially saying, I'm going to adopt the code of your people, the fact that there is a divine law. It wasn't man-written. And finally, when she says, Ba'asher tamus yamus, she is saying that there is a sense of schar v'onish, there's a calibrated balance for our actions. It's not just random, it's not predetermined. There is a repercussion for our actions. So embedded in here, says the Malbim, is not just simply that she's responding to different arenas in Judaism, but rather that she's saying, I'm actually accepting upon myself the very tenets, the very basic tenets of Jewish faith embedded into her speech. Very, very powerful in multiple levels of what she's conveying to her. What is fascinating, and perhaps we'll leave on the side over here, is Orpah. Orpah to me is such a fascinating character. What is Orpah? You know, Rus has made this. Rus has pushed through. She's broken through the veil. She's no longer on the outside. She's now managed to come through. It sounds like she converted, whether here or earlier. Rus has made it. What happened to Orpah? What is Orpah? Our tragic character of the day today, of our triad. What happened to her? There's different ways of looking at Orpah. On the one hand, you can see Orpah as perhaps our passive character. Orpah is the tragedy of passivity. There's a piece written by, I saw this quoted, a piece by Cynthia Ozick, who's a Jewish-American writer, and she wrote about Ruth, and this is what she says about about Orpah. Very powerful words. This, I'm just going to, just a quotation. Her prototype abounds. She has fine impulses, but she has not. She is not an iconoclast. That means a person who pushes against culture. She can push against convention to a generous degree, but it is out of generosity of her temperament, not out of some large metaphysical idea. Meaning she's not an idealist. She is certainly not a philosopher, but neither is she, after 10 years with Naomi, an ordinary Moabite. Not that she has altogether absorbed the Hebrew vision, she is somewhat in between. In this, we may suppose her to be one of us, a modern, no longer a full-fledged member of the pagan world, but always with one foot warming in the seductive bath of the colorful, comfortable, often beautiful, old lies. Not yet given over to the covenant and its determination to train us away from lies, however warm, colorful, beautiful, and consoling lies. So Orpah goes home, or more to the point, she goes nowhere. She is never to be blamed for it. If she is not extraordinary, she is also normal. It is not her the fault of her of the normal that it does not or cannot aspire to the extraordinary. And you think about Orpah is not a bad person, or what Cynthia is arguing over here. She's not a bad person, but she is a person who's sort of just she's like water. She fills the container that she's in, and she's not going to break out of the system that she's in to be able to get to the next place. So under sufficient pressure, what Naomi has done is she said, just sink back. And she sinks back into the culture that she sort of had one foot in, and she disappears from history, which is the way she looks at it. Which is, I feel, to us, I think we can all identify with that sense of the decisions we missed in life. You know, and Orpah sort of just recedes from history at this point in time, and Rus, you know, travels up into the upper hemisphere of Jewish history. But, you know, interestingly enough, and the Medrash doesn't say that. The Medrash says something rather shocking, actually very abrasively shocking. And that is that Orpah did not disappear. In the text that we have, she did disappear. But the Medrash adds on and says that, in fact, on that night, on the way back, she was raped by 100 men and even a dog. Shocking. What does that mean? When you see a shocking medrash like that, it's clearly not, it may be literal, but it may be that perhaps when you say something that abrasive, it's perhaps trying to convey a point. Where does it get the dog from? The reason it gets the dog is because later on, the Philistines have a leader whose name is Goliath. Goliath is a brute of a human being, and extraordinarily large. And he comes up on a daily basis to curse, later in the times of Shaul. He curses the Jewish people, and nobody's willing to be the knight in shining armor to defend themselves, because he's too terrifying. And there goes David, this little boy. It's his first chance to go there. He tries to don the armor falls off him, and he goes up in front of this giant, and the giant says, "Am I like a dog that you send me this little boy?" That's the way he describes it. And the Medrash said, reads into there that if you trace back the lineage of Goliath, Goliath himself comes from Orpah. Goliath is the progeny of Orpah, and David naturally is, of course, the fourth generation descendant of Rus. So there's a re-meeting in history of the person who left and the person who continued. The Rus of the world produced a David, the Orpah of the world produced a Goliath. What the Medrash is trying to say over here is a fascinating thing, and that is that decisions in life aren't neutral. Okay. There's a story about it's called the sour grapes. There's a fox. A fox is trying to get the grapes. He walks around the vineyard. The vineyard is locked. It's fenced in. He can't fit in. He can't dig under. He can't get through the bars. There's no weaknesses. And after hours and hours of desperate trying and trying to climb up the tree next to it, he finally gives up, and he walks off, and he kicks the dirt back behind it, and he says, "They were probably sour grapes anyway." Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of times the way we live life, is that we try very hard for certain things, and when we don't make it, what do? We spurn the decision that we didn't take. Why? Because it justifies, it rationalizes where we are in life, because otherwise we couldn't live with ourselves that we missed out those grapes. What the Medrash is saying is that Orpah was living this ambiguous world where she was somewhat close under the cloak of this Jewish concept. At the same time, she lived a pagan culture that she came from. And here was the point, here was where the fork in the road hit her. And she had to work out, where exactly am I? Who am I? And it was at this point that Naomi puts the pressure on her. But what does Naomi do? Naomi gives her a kiss. A kiss almost is like she's putting into her a little part of herself. You know, I mean, Naomi is sort of imbuing into her daughter-in-law a little aspect, a little bit of her breath, a little bit of who she is. Maybe enough to carry her over, even if she goes back, to carry part of who or who she was into the future that she's going to lead. What's Orpah's action? What does Orpah do before she leaves?
She cries.
The pasuk says she cries and she kisses Naomi. What does that mean? What she's saying is she's giving back anything Naomi gave to her. You see what's happening over here? What she's doing is she's turning on the sour grapes, essentially. She's saying, I can't make this decision. I can't lead the life that I know that destiny wants me to perhaps, and I know that there's something to it. I have to therefore completely divorce myself from it. And therefore she leaves the kiss with Naomi and she returns. And what the Midrash is saying is, she didn't just return. She got completely reinvested in the other pagan life. Completely. Because she couldn't live with that balance which she'd been living up till now, which was one foot in one world and one foot in another. Which is the tragedy of the Orpah. Not just perhaps as our passive character, but perhaps our character spins out of control, as the way the Midrash looks at it, ultimately. And that's, this division in the road is most poignantly remet. We're going to spend a little more time later on rethinking about the David-Goliath reconstitution of this separation which occurs right over here. Anyway, so let's hold it here. Any questions, comments? Marjorie, you had a thought.
Isn't it also somewhat Naomi's responsibility too? Because she had a responsibility to lead then and she pushed her away. And if she had encouraged her, she was in the teacher role.
You're right. It's a very good question. It might be part of what Naomi was doing was testing the sincerity. Meaning, we don't know if Naomi means this or Naomi means to test. It's very hard for us to know that. You could say that she really wants to see how dedicated they are. And maybe the fact that Naomi, crumbled, is perhaps an indication that she wouldn't have made that decision. She wouldn't have been able to make that decision fully. We don't. It's hard to know. But on the other hand, it might be that Naomi's also going through the pain of everything that she doesn't want to share that pain in life anymore. And she's doing this personally for herself and she's lost that opportunity, like you said, which might be then more of a culpability. So I don't know which way to go with that, actually.